Today on the 21st Show, African Americans were long excluded from advertising, or if they were included, it was often in the form of a racist trope or mascot like Aunt Jemima or Uncle Ben. One of the key figures in changing that was Tom Burrell of Chicago, who starting in the 1970s led a black firm making advertising with black people for black people. His story is the subject of the biography Advertising Revolutionary, The Life and Work of Tom Burrell. It's by Illinois advertising professor Jason P. Chambers. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll talk with Chambers for the hour today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WNIJ in Rockford-DeKalb, WVIK in the Quad Cities, and WSIU in Carbondale. But first, news. From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And today we're going to talk about advertising, specifically advertising targeting African-American consumers. This segment of the market was long overlooked or intentionally ignored. All that began to change in the 1960s and 70s as the civil rights movement brought new awareness of black buying power and as gains in equality improved black buying power. Among the people leading this charge was a Chicago man named Tom Burrell. Over the course of 3 decades, he would work with clients such as Marlboro, McDonald's, and Coca-Cola, transforming the advertising industry along the way. His ads were notable for the way they included everyday black folks in everyday situations, working men and women, nuclear families, and single parents, all reflecting life as it was lived by those targeted consumers. On one level, his work was about selling burgers and sodas, but he also had another project in mind, which he summed up in a speech in 2017 when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame for the One Club, which recognizes excellence in advertising creativity.
There is nothing more profoundly important and more powerful to create changes in attitudes and behavior than what you do and what I did. There is nothing more powerful than the power of positive propaganda, and that can help tremendously, more than anything else, to save this world.
Tom Burrell's life and work are the subject of a book called Advertising Revolutionary by University of Illinois advertising professor Jason P. Chambers. I spoke with Chambers back in 2024. Professor Chambers, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Thank you for having me.
All right, let's begin with some background. What was the relationship between advertising and African Americans before the Civil Rights Movement?
Well, prior to the Civil Rights Movement, where African Americans were considered in advertising, they were considered to be objects rather than subjects. They were objects to be used in advertising. African American figures like Aunt Jemima to sell pancake mix, the chef for Cream of Wheat, whose name was Rastus, was used to sell that breakfast cereal to folks. Uncle Ben, the trade character for the Venerable Rice brand. So they were used as objects in selling, but not so much as subjects to be advertised to, as a valuable group of consumers to eat that pancake mix or that rice or that cream of wheat. So objects rather than subjects.
Why was that? Is it pure and simple racism? Is it ignorance?
It's a combination of the two. You've got to remember that African Americans are still, you know, 10 to 12% of the population. And so at that time in advertising, the idea was to aim at the largest markets possible. We thought in terms of large markets, large groups, that the most profitable opportunities were in aggregating the largest groups possible. So it's not until the 1950s in which the concept of market segmentation really takes hold in the advertising business, this idea of segmenting groups of consumers into more valuable and more efficiently targeted groups of folks. And so there had been things like that before with targeting of farmers or targeting of women and things of that nature in the 1930s. But it's as we get into the 1950s with the explosion of things like television and other communications mediums that allows for this greater sense of targeting of groups of people. And so in the aftermath of World War II in that 1940s into 1950s period, this appearance, this emphasis on the internal market, as it was called at the time, of Negroes, their word, this internal market of Negroes in the United States began to grow in visibility and importance and recognized value due to the work of African Americans, really in media, people like John H. Johnson and others who published magazines that really are introducing American corporations and agencies to this internal market in the United States.
What does the advertising industry itself look like at this point?
Lily White would be a fair description. You're talking about an industry in which the number of African Americans are measured in the single digits. The numbers are measured in the ones and the twos here and there. There were few enough that they could be identified. They knew one another in New York primarily. So it's an industry world in the major cities. It's based primarily in New York, but it's an industry world in which race is really fairly homogenous. And I say that, though, to say that there was a time in advertising when you couldn't be Jewish and just work in any agency. You couldn't be Italian and just work in any agency. You couldn't be Greek and just work in any agency. So there was a real racially restrictive nature to the agency world in the 1950s and early 1960s.
I mean, I don't know what your opinion is of the TV show Mad Men, but it's very WASPish, right, in that portrayal, at least.
Absolutely. There was a certain, one of the things Mr. Burrell said about it was there was a certain WASPish patrician nature to advertising at the time. The idea being, you know, we're hiring people who look like us, who go to the clubs that we go to, that live in the neighborhoods that we live in, that went to the schools or belong to the fraternities that we lived in. So there's a very specific kind of image of the ad men of the 1940s and of the 1950s. And they played on that image, that idea, that visual. And so I think Mad Men got that part particularly right.
So how do Black creatives begin to get a toehold in this industry?
Really, it starts in the music part, the music portion of the advertising industry. One of the things that agencies no longer do, one of the things they did at the time, is that agencies in the 1950s and prior to, they had radio departments. They had television departments. There was a time at which advertising agencies wrote some of the scripts that people were hearing on radio, wrote some of the scripts for the television programs that people were hearing on, or excuse me, viewing on TV. And so the music departments, back when agencies still produced their own original music, their own original jingles for content, when those things were held in-house. Well, African-American musicians were operating as professionals, visible professionals out there in the popular music landscape. And so that gave opportunities for those African-American producers, those writers, those musicians to come into agencies for periods of time, come into those agencies and work in these music departments, developing jingles and developing the background music that went with the advertisements.
How do they go from the recording studio into the creative suites, though?
Slowly.
Yeah.
Very, very slowly. Because, again, there was a sense that, especially if you're talking about mainstream agencies, that as one ad man said, perhaps a little more candidly than he would have liked looking back historically, that Black people couldn't write white. Was the idea that if we don't have something here that we're going to be selling to African Americans, then the sense is, well, then what's the use of their being here necessarily? And so there's this slow movement, though, in the 1960s, particularly as an aspect of the civil rights movement is ramping up, and they're expanding into considerations of the treatment, the visual, just the general reception of African Americans in the United States. And the idea is that the question is, what can we do to help kind of normalize the presence of African Americans in the business and in the country, rather? And so one of the areas and the places and spaces that these activists looked at was the media space, inclusive of television, inclusive of radio, and certainly inclusive of advertising. And so you get this kind of growing pressure in the 1960s to bring more racial diversity. They wouldn't have used the word diversity, of course, but to bring more racial integration into the advertising industry business. And so you get this push to go out and find African Americans that can be brought into agencies to be given these opportunities. And the areas of opportunity where they were most visible would have been in the copywriting and the creative portions and or in the media research or traffic portions of the agency beyond the musical areas that I mentioned earlier.
Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with University of Illinois advertising professor Jason Chambers. His latest book is called Advertising Revolutionary, The Life and Work of Tom Burrell. Let's talk about Burrell now. So I don't want to spend too much time on this. You have a couple of chapters in your book on it, but what was his early life like? What was his child life like? childhood like?
His early life was tough. His early life was tough from the standpoint of his relationship with his father. His father was an entrepreneur, as his mother was. His father was a business owner, a tavern owner in Chicago. He ran a number of businesses, had real estate interests and operations, was a bail bondsman for a time. So he was a man who worked for himself. He was a man who acquired cash for himself. But any lessons that he could have learned or that he did learn as an entrepreneur, he refused implicitly refused to pass on to his son. He was what could be described as emotionally abusive, not necessarily physically abusive, but emotionally abusive and sometimes even often dismissive of his son and or his family's needs. When Burrell was a young man, his mother separated from his father, and he at that portion of his life, because of the level of income that the family had lost once the two parents had separated, he often spent time moving between relatives, still in Chicago, but moving between his mother and mother's side and father's side relatives in Chicago. So he was a young man who spent a lot of time trying to necessarily to find himself, right, from going from group to group to see where he would or could fit in into these various spaces. And so that's one of the things he talks about in his early life is that, you know, sometimes he might be trying to hang out with the athletes, and then some other times he might be trying to hang out with the street toughs, just trying to find the place and the space where he kind of fit in into the world.
What were his communities like at that time? This is Chicago of the Great Migration era, or I guess his parents' generation more so than his. But what would life have been like for him?
Well, he's still very much living in that segregated part of South Chicago. You know, we're still talking, he's born in 1939, we're still talking about a young man growing up in the 1940s and in the early 1950s, still in a very much segregated city. You know, we often think of Chicago as a city when it's really more accurately described probably as a series of small villages that are in close proximity to one another, because you've got the neighborhoods that are Greek or that are Italian or that in this case, are African-American. And so he's growing up in that environment, but he's also growing up kind of behind this segregated veil, and he's seeing African-Americans in various entrepreneurial pursuits, and he's seeing African-Americans working together to necessarily build the neighborhood, build their communities, build businesses, rely on one another, work for one another, give opportunities, provide opportunities for one another, network with one another. And so he's also getting that opportunity to have that experience, to see what happens when African-Americans work together, work for one another, even though it's behind this necessarily behind this segregated veil in a residential sense. He's getting the opportunity to see that in operation in Chicago, because Chicago is that home at that time. Chicago is that great Black metropolis where African-Americans are visible in politics, they're visible in education, they're visible in the business pursuits. So he's growing up in that incubator as well in those 1940s and 1950s period.
The Building the Black Metropolis, the title of one of your previous books. I like how you worked that in there. Let's fast forward then. Why advertising? How does he get into that industry?
Accidentally. It's really an interesting story. He often remarks on it. It's part of his origin story. He had transferred schools trying to better himself. He had transferred schools from Inglewood to Parker High School. So he transferred schools when he was a sophomore in high school. And as part of his transfer, not necessarily an official part of it, but one of the courses that he took at Parker was a careers course. And so as part of those careers courses, they took aptitude testing just to give students a series of questions, multiple choice type questions, series of questions to allow students to maybe see what types of careers they could be interested in. And his came back with the areas of, you know, kind of his opportunity or his kind of special skill set were the areas of kind of creativity and persuasion. I don't know that those were the official titles, but he went to his teacher and he asked what that meant. And this is an important moment, and I don't want to overlook this, because you're talking about Chicago, America, in the 1950s when this comes up. And it would have not been uncommon, and it was not uncommon, for teachers to steer Black students into areas where they felt they could find opportunity, into areas, careers, job titles where they felt they could find a chance to get a job and earn a living when they left high school. And so it wouldn't have been uncommon for the teacher to say something like, means you'd be a good postal worker. Nothing against the postal worker, but that was an area where Black people could get a job. So it would have been maybe natural for a teacher to steer a student who asked a question into those areas, give them an answer that'll lead them to opportunity. But what the teacher said was, well, it means that you'd maybe be a good advertising copywriter. And he didn't know what that meant. His friends didn't know what that meant. Now, he surrounded himself at Parker after transferring from Englewood. He surrounded himself with people that, in his words, are going places. People, his fellow students who want to be lawyers, fellow students who want to be doctors, fellow students who have a vision of their future, whatever that future may be in an occupational sense. And so when he now is able to go to them and say, I'm going to be a copywriter, that gives him something to talk about. Whereas prior to that, maybe other conversations in the lunchroom had been about, hey, I'm going to go to law school. Or, hey, I'm going to go to medical school. Now he's got this new and interesting story to tell about, I'm going to be a copywriter. I'm going to be an advertising copywriter. And then he threw himself into, other than the title, he threw himself into learning what that meant, reading about the possibilities and visioning that possibility for himself. So that seminal moment, that interaction, that influence of just his high school teacher and a conversation that perhaps was one of thousands that she had with students over the years was absolutely professionally impactful for him.
Just about 30 seconds before we need to take a break, but as I just want to remind people, this is where you said this industry has people of African Americans you can measure in the single digits, right, at this point. And yet he saw his way in. Was he ever discouraged in that pursuit?
Was he discouraged? Sure. Yeah, he was discouraged. At one point, he actually left advertising and went overseas. So he was discouraged to the point in the mid-1960s, after transferring from one agency, his initial agency, to another, to the Leo Burnett Agency in Chicago. He got so discouraged as to his possibilities in advertising that he left and he went overseas and left the industry for a number of weeks.
Let me reintroduce my guest. Jason Chambers is a professor of advertising at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. In 2024, he came out with the book Advertising Revolutionary, The Life and Work of Tom Burrell. Burrell's a legendary Chicago ad man who helped create a new branch of his field, advertising featuring black people that was aiming to reach black people. I spoke with Chambers in 2024. Because this conversation's on tape, we're not taking calls today, but you can let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. We'll continue our conversation after a short break. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jason P. Chambers, who's an advertising professor at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. He was previously also the Associate Dean for Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion in the College of Media. Now he's the Associate Dean for Access and Engagement. His latest book is Advertising Revolutionary, The Life and Work of Tom Burrell. It came out in 2024, which is when I originally spoke with Chambers for this conversation. As we were talking about before the break, Tom Burrell is an African-American. He was born and raised in Chicago. He entered the advertising industry at a time when black people were very uncommon there. And one of his key insights as he is building his career is that, and I'm just going to paraphrase here, but black people are not dark-skinned white people, right? And this is something the advertising industry struggled with, right? And one of these campaigns was the Marlboro Man. Everybody knows this cowboy, white man out on the range. Why didn't that work for black consumers?
Well, for African-American consumers, you've got a disjuncture between the rural landscape of the life of the cowboy, the man out there, the individual on a horse, living that Marlboro life in the, you know, the Marlboro universe. And so this image of the Marlboro man, this Western image of the cowboy, doesn't necessarily fit in Burrell's research. The work that he had done as he built that campaign doesn't necessarily fit in his research, because he says, in terms of what they find, is that for African Americans, what they see as being the optimal male image is one who is involved, one who is in their community working with others, not out there working necessarily as a solo operator, working and living by themselves, but they're involved in their community, they're involved in their neighborhood, they're working to make things better for the folks around them, whereas the cowboy was often pictured as, again, a lone individual, the only person, the only entity, the only living thing around was a horse and maybe a few cows. At that point at which they're doing this and they're building that campaign in the early 1970s, that's just not a vision of individualism that is ideal in the African-American community. No, that sense is at that time of working together to build us as a people. And obviously the urban nature of it as well, right? More of an urban people than a rural people at that time.
So you could imagine that white advertising execs would have said, well, we'll just put an African-American man in a cowboy hat, although they wouldn't have used that language at the time, but right. And then that's the campaign. What does Burrell come up with?
What he comes up with is what they call the urban Marlboro man. And it is a series of images of African-American men of action, working, walking, moving throughout their neighborhood, perhaps getting stopping to get something at a fruit stand while obviously having and holding a Marlboro, or stopping to get a suit made while having and holding a Marlboro. But again, embedding them within the community, embedding them in an urban setting, in an urban environment that would be more familiar to the audience of viewers and smokers that Marlboro was targeting at the time.
Interestingly, there were a couple of issues with this campaign, and it had to do with people showing up in the background who were not happy about this. I guess some hard lessons learned there.
Absolutely. Some hard lessons learned. When Burrell starts his agency, he actually starts with a partner named Emmett McBain. Emmett McBain was a fantastic creative mind. But one of the challenges that they had was as McBain was striving to deliver on these kind of action photographs, you know, man of action, man in his neighborhood, kind of man about town, man about the south or west sides of Chicago. Well, as they're taking these shots, people appeared in the background, and unfortunately, some of them appeared a little too closely in focus, too visibly in focus, I should say, in some of the ads. And so you had this experience of one gentleman in particular I discuss in the book, where he essentially called the folks at Marlboro and essentially said, hey, I'm in this advertisement and I'm anti-smoking. I'm a preacher. I shouldn't be in this advertisement. Why is this image there? I see and I recognize myself in this ad. Now, he's in the background. He's in a soft focus, but if you can recognize yourself in a photograph and you kind of catch the and can recognize the surrounding scenes, then you're able to say, as he was, yeah, that's me. And so there's that sense of pushback from the folks at Philip Morris. And ultimately, they do resign that account, not because of those mistakes, but they ultimately do leave that account.
And never go back to tobacco, interestingly, which was so lucrative for ad agencies, at least at the time. Let's jump ahead to McDonald's, because there's a lot in the book on this client relationship. And I think there's a lot of interesting lessons here about Burrell and his approach to his work. In the early 1970s, McDonald's main advertising tagline was, "You deserve a break today." All right, Advertising Age calls that the jingle of the century later on. Burrell says that doesn't work for black audiences, like the Marlboro Man. Why not?
Because one of the things is that he recognizes, again, through research and analysis, is that the concept of the break was one that was really built for white families. The concept of the break was that McDonald's was something that you visited as a treat. McDonald's is something that you did occasionally. McDonald's is something that you went to maybe once a week on a weekend or after a ball game or something along those lines. And what his research says, as he's sitting and he's researching McDonald's restaurants in urban Chicago, as he's watching black people come in and out of these restaurants, he's recognizing and he sees this isn't a break for African Americans. This isn't a break for black people. These kids, these parents, these folks are here multiple times per day. Maybe they're not purchasing, and they're not purchasing entire meals at a time. They're not purchasing a Coke, some French fries, and a hamburger all as one purchase and only in one visit. They may be coming back three and four times, once to get that Coke, and then they come back again to get a hamburger. Then they come back again a little later to get to get those French fries or a chocolate shake. And so what he recognizes is this isn't a break for them. This is a place that they are going multiple times per day. So that sense of you deserve a break today doesn't fit, because that's not their operational experience in these restaurants. And so he changes that to get down with something good. Positions McDonald's as being this presence in the African-American neighborhood. neighborhood, this presence at which they are multiple times per day. They're there in the morning. They may be there in the afternoon during a lunch break, and they may be there again in the evening for dinner.
And these ad campaigns, you mentioned Get Down With Something Good. Later that becomes Sure Is Good To Have Around. It's this idea of McDonald's as almost a community center. And it's worth remembering that in some of these neighborhoods, these had been predominantly white neighborhoods or mixed neighborhoods. But then you have the uprisings and unrest of the 60s. There's white flight. Some of these McDonald's are owned by white men who sell to African-American entrepreneurs. And these communities, some of them have been, I think, now we would say disinvested in at the time. They weren't rebuilt by the city after some of the problems there. And they really serve as hubs in their neighborhoods.
Sure. Sure. And one of the things is, you know, we look at McDonald's as the international conglomerate that they are now. And we, you know, we kind of consider them as always kind of having and knowing the answer, always having and known, you know, figuring things out and always getting it right. And, you know, when we turn the clock back to the 1970s period in which we're talking about, this is still a corporation that's very much still figuring it out, very much still learning about what it takes to develop into this national level fast food franchise. And at the same time, we're up against competitors, you know, the Burger Kings and the Wendy's and others that have maybe passed into history at this point. And what they're recognizing is that, you know, we've got a central population in these cities, in these neighborhoods. Okay, we've already got McDonald's restaurants there. If those restaurants fail, it's not that fast food is never coming back to those neighborhoods. It just may not be us. It may be a Burger King. It may be a Wendy's. It may be an unnamed other, if you will. And so having that sense of being able to build that presence in those neighborhoods, become that center, become that aspect of life for African-American consumers, that's all due to Burrell. Certainly it's due to the internal marketing genius of McDonald's as well. But from a positioning standpoint, the work that Burrell does for McDonald's is unparalleled in terms of helping to build that company's presence in the African-American consumer's mind.
I want to come back to the idea of positive realism and the actual visual content of some of these ads, but I'm looking at one, and I just want to give people a flavor of this. There's a young man, looks like he's with a youth group of some sort, sitting at outside a van, Get Down With Something Good at McDonald's. Some of the copy here, you know, is trying to really resonate, I think, with working class African Americans at the time. On the real side, kids can really dig getting down at McDonald's. In some of my research for this conversation, I've come across a number of modern takes on these ads that frankly find them racist, right? There was a Daily Mail piece that speculated the copywriter was possibly white with a jive-talking fixation. And I found another video very well done by a young YouTube documentarian, himself black, who said the Get Down With A Cheeseburger type ads, quote, kind of read like they were written by a bunch of white people trying to sound like black people. And they were. I feel like that scene where Woody Allen has Marshall McLuhan with him. So you have written the book on a man who came up with these ads. Talk about that. What do you make of how those ads are received today versus what they were intended to do at the time?
Well, I think the thing is that we have a tendency in our search for clicks and in our search for views, we have a tendency to try to fuel the rage machine. And in doing so, we try to find and we point out things and we say, look at all that was wrong with this. And because of that, we pull it out of its historical context. We look at things with our modern eye and say, this is all the reasons why this is wrong. And in their very analysis, it's clear that they have no idea, they have no clue who actually put that ad together. And because they have no clue who put the ad together, they have no clue as to the why behind the actions of the copywriter. They don't know, for example, that African Americans are completely absent in advertising before this. They don't know and understand the importance of patterns of speech as a marker of recognition and celebration of a community in a moment rather than as some type of negative knock against the way that folks speak. And so I think there's a certain sense of simply being ahistorical in search of generating outrage. And really, it's a lack of insight, and it portrays a lack of learning. It goes to a person who pulls an image out of a magazine and then from 1970 whatever, and then does nothing in terms of reading anything at all about 1970 whatever. I know nothing about 1975, and I know nothing about 1975, the advertising industry in Chicago, McDonald's advertising. And so then I sit with my camera and my microphone, and I say all the things that are wrong with this. And really, I present myself as an ignorant fool in my own estimation. And I've seen those articles. I've seen them in publications as grand as The Atlantic. And it really does evidence a real lack of analysis and a real limited effort on the part of the person putting together the piece.
Well, I think that's a good segue then into what Burrell was trying to do. And this is one of his big sort of big ideas from his career, and that is positive realism. What is positive realism?
Positive realism, one of the things that Burrell said was that African Americans outside of periodicals, so the magazines and the newspapers that are specifically aimed at them, that African Americans didn't see themselves portrayed in advertising and in the major television programs, the major radio networks, the major newspapers, what have you, that they didn't see themselves. And if they did see themselves, it was because if they were represented, they were represented by somebody who had done, had some extraordinary achievement. They were a professional baseball player or football player. They were known for something. They were a celebrity of some kind. They were a singer.
Globetrotters or, yeah.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. Something like the Globetrotters. So they were known. So they had this kind of superstar level. And what positive realism was an effort to bring the regular African American into advertising. Just the people that have families, the people that are working down at the post office, the people that are driving the bus, just people who, other than the folks who know them, wouldn't be recognizable to anybody on the street. So he wants to bring a more human, a more regular image of African Americans into advertising and to bring this positive, right, away from the negativity of the Aunt Jemimas and the Rastuses and the Uncle Bens of the world, to bring this positive and realistic. In other words, how African Americans really live and look and feel and think. He wanted to bring that into advertising and present that to folks and unite that with products, unite that with McDonald's, or unite that with Coca-Cola as a way to kind of both humanize African Americans, but also centralize these products in the roles of or in the lives of regular folks.
And he has a lot of fathers and sons. He has nuclear families. As I mentioned at the beginning of the show, he has single mothers. He tries to reflect a broad range of experiences.
Absolutely. He's trying to reflect a broad range of experiences, but he's also trying to present an image that is anti to the prevailing image that folks are getting in the news media or that folks are getting of African Americans in other forms of media, these kinds of negative or stereotypical representations, or that the only images of African Americans that are seen or is of them as criminals or amongst the downtrodden, the destitute, folks that need help. And what he is bringing to that, though, is a sense of African-American aspiration, a sense of African-American aspiration for education, for family, for love, for relationship, for a hopeful future, for the beauty of African-American women and men and children and families and couples. And so that is part of that broadening of the African-American image that's Burrell's real contribution to the advertising industry, is to this humanization of the African-American image on behalf, yes, of selling products, but in demonstrating its positive impact both on a client's bottom line and their profits, but also the loyalty of African-American for their products, but also, again, this better, this more humanistic image of African Americans as people, consumers, yes, but also as people, is what he's bringing to the advertising industry.
All right, let's listen to an example of this. This ad is called Double Dutch. I found several McDonald's ads called Double Dutch over the years. I'm not sure if this is specifically one that Burrell and his agency worked on. This is from 1982.
Come on, let's try. Big Mac, filet, fish, quarter pound of French fries, icy cold, thick shake, Sunday's apple pie.
All right, just a minute until we need to take another break. But, I mean, this is an ad that both white audiences and black audiences can appreciate, right? In different ways, perhaps.
Yeah, absolutely. Because you've got African Americans who get the opportunity to see themselves involved in an activity that they are familiar with, many of them, so not everybody everywhere all the time, of course, but see them doing an activity. Black girls out jumping Double Dutch, something that my wife did as a young woman. They get to see that. But then white consumers also get to see something that they maybe have not seen before, but that also they can see and they can link with. Young girls jumping rope outside of a home, having fun, smiling, laughing, while, again, enjoying the product in question.
Let me reintroduce our conversation. We're speaking with Jason P. Chambers, professor of advertising at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and the author most recently of Advertising Revolutionary, The Life and Work of Tom Burrell, the legendary Chicago advertising man who was one of the pioneers of making advertising not only that marketed to Black people, but was made with and featuring Black people. Positive realism. We're going to talk more about some of these concepts when we return. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey, and we are talking today with Jason Chambers, who is a professor of advertising at the University of Illinois. His latest book is about a Chicago man named Tom Burrell. It's called Advertising Revolutionary, The Life and Work of Tom Burrell. And with his agency, he worked with major clients over the years, McDonald's, Coca-Cola, Ford, Toyota, and really changed the advertising industry forever by making ads, not just subbing in African Americans for white models, as was done early in the sort of post-civil rights awakening of the advertising industry, but really making ads with and for African American consumers. And before the break, we were talking about this idea of positive realism, sort of slices of everyday life where Black customers could see themselves in advertising. This comes up again. That was what we were talking about with the McDonald's campaign. That was in the 70s. It comes up again in the 90s when agencies and brands are trying to tap into authentic hip-hop culture, right? There had been MC Hammer. There had been Vanilla Ice. But, you know, I mean, is that real hip-hop? We can debate about that. But there was a dilemma for advertising agencies. What was that?
Well, the dilemma at the time is that they're scared. They're scared of the hip hop artists of the moment. Here we're talking having come through the, you know, the growth of hip hop in the 1980s and into the 1990s. And there was a lot of negativity around hip hop. There was a time at which, you know, MTV has kind of fallen in importance and its visibility amongst folks. But there was a time at which, you know, when MTV was, you know, the major source for people to see artists in the music videos, there was a time at which they wouldn't play hip hop artists. There were fears of what would happen if a hip hop artists came and gave a concert in a city. There were instances where CDs and tapes of hip-hop artists were destroyed for their lyrics and their corruption of the community. And so there's these fears of violence and this miscegenation. So there's a lot of negativity around the hip-hop artists, especially those who, as someone who was very much into the culture at the time, a young man in my 20s, would have said that, no, MC Hammer is not real hip-hop. No, Vanilla Ice is not real hip-hop. That is not a taking away from their talent, but are they real hip-hop in the way that somebody like a KRS-One was? Are they real hip-hop in the way that somebody like a Public Enemy was, an Ice Cube was? The answer is absolutely not. And so there is that fear, though, of once we get beyond the, you know, the pop version of hip-hop that is MC Hammer, that is Vanilla Ice, well, do we really want to use those artists in advertising? And for brands, the answer was no, until Burrell comes along.
And once again, positive realism is the answer. Let's listen to an ad. This is for Sprite, the soft drink, part of the Coca-Cola company. The ad's called Freestylin'.
This is how we work it. Grab the big Sprite and, you know, we jerk it right out the fridge. It's just like this with a dib, dab, dib. Yeah.
I give a pound to my man with my right hand, because I keep the Sprite in the left hand,
okay.
And then I push the button when I don't want to hear nothing.
It's Crispy
I let
Queen.
It go when I want to hear something.
Yeah.
This is how we flow when we in the studio, freestyle with Sprite, yo, how the rest go. First things first, a big yo thirst, Sprite, all right?
All right, I got to admit, this has always been the brand association of Sprite for me because I didn't have cable until I got to college in the late 90s. But this was a major brand repositioning. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. You're talking about Sprite at the time is a brand that's in trouble. It's in their words, not mine, it is a brand that is in the soccer mom category, the if I don't have anything else to drink category. It doesn't really have a strong identity, and that's kind of internal, the way they kind of described it internally at Coke. It doesn't really have an identity beyond that. It's this clear beverage that's kind of like 7-Up, this lemony, limey flavor, if you will, but it doesn't really have a strong identity. And so it's a brand that has an opportunity. And thanks to the work of a young man inside Coke by the name of Daryl Cobbins, and the things that he does internally to build and learn about the possible connection between Sprite and other communities. And he sees hip hop as the hip hop community as a viable, necessarily opportunity. And so with that, that vision from Cobbin internally at Coca-Cola, combined with kind of what they have at Burrell kind of externally, as Burrell was Coke's minority agency at the time, uniting those two together builds this opportunity for Sprite and for the hip hop community.
And he has a social sort of motivation in what he's doing here, right, too? And I don't know if you want to talk about the Voltron advertisement. Maybe we need to remind listeners who did not watch the 80s cartoon of the five robots that came together to form one giant robot.
Yeah, absolutely, because what you have there is the desire to present the artistry of hip-hop, because Cobbin was a fan of hip-hop, a fan of true hip-hop. His counterpart at Burrell, a young genius created by the name of Reggie Jolly, he was a fan of hip-hop, a Chicagoan. He was a fan of hip-hop. And so they wanted to bring this vision of this real-world connection between hip-hop and the artists and their music and their talent, and they wanted to infuse that into the commercials. And so they put that into a series in the late 1990s in which they incorporate the anime that is part of the Voltron robot with five artists from the various geographical areas of hip-hop, from New York, from the South, from Chicago, from the Midwest, and from the West Coast. And so the idea there was, at a time in which hip-hop was experiencing some internal discord, to have this coming together, this union across these kind of geographic and stylistic lines of the moment, have that sense, that visual, that emphasis on uniting together as a hip-hop community, as visualized through the uniting together of these five different parts of the Voltron robot to come together into one more powerful, larger robot that is ultimately Voltron.
I want to spend the rest of our time talking a little bit about some other aspects of Tom Burrell's sort of business philosophy. He turned down clients who were offering, especially in the early days, what was called goodwill or conscience money. He made this pitch to Gillette, the shaving company. It did not go the way he hoped. Can you tell that story briefly?
Absolutely. The idea was at the time that many large corporations, what they wanted was the opportunity to say that they were adhering to the affirmative action, whether they were rules, guidelines, laws, traditions. They wanted to have an African-American agency, or they wanted to have a minority supplier. The challenge was that all they wanted to do was to pay that supplier, to pay that agency. The idea was that we'll give you money, but we don't actually need you to do any actual work for us. And so what Burrell recognized is that was what he called conscience money. That was a gift. And his belief was, his strategy was, thought was, that anytime you're giving me a gift, then you don't have any reason, you don't have to worry about taking it away, because I'm not providing you. You don't see me as providing you. My agency is providing you with any value. And so if we don't have any value to you, then I can't count on you remaining as a client. My people can't count on delivering their best work for you. Maybe they won't feel that they have to deliver their best work for you because you don't actually care, because the only thing we're here for is to say essentially that you've got a black friend, that you've got a black agency. And so Burrell rejected accounts like that because he knew that ultimately he could not build an agency that would last the long term on clients like that, with beliefs and ideas like that.
You write about also his attempts to take the Burrell agency into what's called a general market agency. Maybe you can tell listeners what that was and why he had such struggles with that.
The general market agency, in the parlance of the time, we still use that phrase today. General market agency would have been an agency that is the designed to reach the largest group of consumers, specifically designed to reach, generally speaking, Caucasian consumers. That's the largest, racially speaking, that's the largest market group. And so the general market agency is the one that has usually the largest piece of the business. They have the largest part of the account versus we may have a smaller agency that does our public relations. We may have a smaller agency that does our marketing to the Hispanic community. The general general market agency has the largest piece of the pie, if you will. And what he tried to do was to get into that portion of the advertising business because that's where the largest, that's where the most money is. That's where the largest dollars are. Because if you have $100 million in your advertising budget, maybe you're spending $15 million of that on the African-American market, maybe $10 million on the Hispanic market at the time. But that other remaining $75 million is maybe going to, in this example, is going to the general market agency, but that agency is ostensibly writing, creating, crafting advertising to reach white consumers. The idea being, well, that if you're black, you don't really know, you don't have the expertise, the skill set, the parlance to be able to write to white consumers.
I mean, what is Burrell's ultimate conclusion there? Is it just racism? Is there something to that? How has the industry continued to evolve since he stepped back from his day-to-day role?
He would say it would have been a combination of things. Is racism part of it? Certainly. I gave you the quote earlier from a gentleman by the name of Jerry DeLaFamina, in which he said black people can't write white. So is some of it racism? Sure. Some of that is a part of it. People have a tendency to do business with people that they think are most like them, and the people that are deciding upon the business, even if I'm not racist per se, this white guy is just kind of like me. He lives in a similar neighborhood, has a similar background. I'm more comfortable around him. So people have to get, you know, into that, you know, more diverse community to be able to work with an agency or a group of folks that are, you know, maybe that they perceive to not be like them. So is it all racism? Absolutely not. It also could be a factor of size. Some people would say that, okay, Coca-Cola, if we want to use them as an example, Coca-Cola couldn't turn over its general market business to all of it to Burrell because they wouldn't have been of the requisite size to be able to handle them, their work throughout the entirety of the United States. So a portion of it, yes. All of it, no, because they don't have the size and the reach to handle all of it. So it's a combination of factors. It's a complicated picture. He's a thoughtful man, and he certainly doesn't ascribe all of it to racism, but he would certainly say, is that a part of it? Was that a part of it? Absolutely.
As we're coming to the end of our time, I want to return to that speech Burrell gave in 2017 when he was inducted into the One Club Hall of Fame. He mentioned that as he was on his way to that speech, he had been at the funeral for the civil rights activist and comedian Dick Gregory and had seen notable figures like John Lewis, C.T. Vivian, and the children of Dr. King, Medgar Evers, and Malcolm X, all of whom were assassinated. And this is what he had to say.
And here I am on my way to receive an award for writing commercials, selling burgers and fries. But the thing that was most profound is that those people, especially John Lewis, said to me, "Thank you for what you do." Wait a minute, you were out on the front line getting halfway beaten to death and you're thanking me? That is a gift. That is an amazing recognition. I have to say it's a recognition that surpasses this one. But it's also a recognition that created this one.
And this brings us back to Burrell's ideas about positive propaganda, as he termed it early on, for African Americans on behalf of Black America. What is his legacy going to be 50 years from now, 100 years from now?
That's an excellent question. I think that his legacy is going to be for what he brought to the advertising business in terms of this visualization of African Americans as a people worthy of emulation, people worthy of admiration, people worthy of inspiration, not because they're superstars on a football field or a basketball court or a baseball diamond, but just as regular folks whose success is in making their way through the world. Their success is in the support for their families, their neighborhoods, their institutions, their support for other groups of people in other communities, the LGBTQ community or the Americans of Different Physical Abilities community. So that bringing together of those types of images on behalf of selling products, of course, on behalf of selling those burgers and fries that he said, but within that, recognizing this social power of advertising, that we're doing multiple things at the same time, that at the same time that we're selling these products, we're also presenting folks with an image of what they should consider to be normal, or an image of what they should try to emulate, or an image of what it is that they should aspire to. And I think he's going to be put on in and amongst that list and group of luminaries who broaden the advertising field to be about more than just the selling of products.
The book is called Advertising Revolutionary, The Life and Work of Tom Burrell. Its author is Jason P. Chambers. He's a professor at the University of Illinois. Dr. Chambers, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Our conversation with Jason Chambers first aired in 2024. That's it for us today. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we continue our conversations with candidates for the U.S. Senate. Republican Casey Chlebek emigrated with his family from Poland in the 1960s. For decades, he worked in information technologies. Now he runs a real estate management business. If you have questions for him, email us. Our address is talk@21stshow.org. talk@21stshow.org. That's also the address of our website where you can find our voicemail line, social media, and every other way to contact us. We've got our past conversations there, including with other candidates for U.S. Senate in Illinois. And you can find links to subscribe to our podcasts, or just look us up on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. The 21st Show is produced by Christine Hatfield and Jose Zepeda. Our digital producer is Coulson Khan. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick's our news director. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.